Where warp meets weft.
Where warp meets weft.
This is Weavecast with Sine Mitchell.
Hello, and welcome to Weavecast. This is episode 50. This week we chat with James Kohler, a tapestry artist who does amazing things with depth and color. We talk about his work, spirituality and inspiration, and his upcoming gallery show that will be launched at Convergence. I have an update on the 40th Blanket Project. The launch party was great fun. Thank you everyone who made the trek out. Since then, I've been spending a lot of time winding warps, and it turns out that building up a huge pile of random yarns and then picking warps out of them is a great way to learn about color. I talk about some of the things I learned in my latest blog post, All Wound Up. Facebook. I finally got over my fear of Facebook. Yes, I know, I'm a technically savvy person, but Facebook, I don't know, there was just something about the interface that intimidated me. But I'm over that now. I have fixed up my own personal Facebook page, as well as created a weave zine page. So there will be links to those in the show notes if you want to go check those out. On the development side of things, I am currently working on redesigning the site. We have a great design on the site, but as I've added more and different types of content, it's really kind of bursting at the seams. These days, we not only have feature articles and podcasts, but we also have events and reviews and product announcements and news stories. And I've got some new features in the works that need a place to live. So I'm working with a designer and re-architecting the homepage. Now, if there's anything that you've always wished you could change about the look and feel of the site, now is the time to let me know so we can roll that feedback into our plans. You can either email me at editor@weavezine.com, or you can use the Contact Us form up on the main weavezine.com website. Our sponsor this episode is Lunatic Fringe Yarns. They sell a variety of yarns and weaving kits, including their famous Tubular Spectrum and Gray Matter Color Gamp kits, which are wonderful tools for learning about color. You can find them online at lunaticfringeyarns.com. As always, there will be a link to that in the show notes.
I'm James Kohler, and I live in Santa Fe, New Mexico.
You do amazing tapestries. How did you come to be a weaver?
The story is a little bit unusual in that I learned to weave tapestry while living as a Benedictine monk in a very small monastery in northern New Mexico. When I first went to the monastery, there were five other men there. And shortly after that, a couple of them left, so we were down to four for a while. Everybody wove or was connected in some way to the weaving process. Some people just did prep work. One of the monks affectionately called it chooch work, getting warps ready and getting plant matter for dyeing and all of that kind of thing. That's how the monks made a living, and I really didn't have a choice. I was told I was going to learn to weave. And I didn't know they were weavers when I went to that particular monastery.
When you were told that you were going to learn to weave and then you started weaving, I mean, what was the experience like for you?
I've always been one who's liked working with my hands. That's always been true from the time I was very young. I just took to it and really liked it. Before too long, became somewhat passionate about it. Life in the monastery is really about meditation, contemplation, coming to a place in one's life where you experience God or the Creator and everything. And I found that the whole process of weaving, passing back and forth of the shuttle through the loom, was something that really focused me and centered me and allowed me to experience what it was I went there to experience. So it was sort of a means to an end.
I took a workshop from you the other day, and you told a very interesting story about how weaving actually became part of your meditative process. Mm-hmm. Could you talk a little bit about that?
At the monastery, our days were spent in three different sections that were pretty much evenly divided. We had prayer as a community together, we had private prayer, and then we had work. And we slept some and we ate some too, but those were the primary activities during the day, and they were pretty much evenly divided. not very long after I started weaving, and I discovered that the meditative quality of sitting at the loom of weaving was very conducive to my experiencing the creator through the creative process. And for me personally, given personality and everything else, all the idiosyncrasies about myself, it just worked better in terms of meditation. And when I went to the monastery to experience, I experienced while I was sitting at the loom and while in the chapel praying and meditating with everybody else. But to just sit by myself in my cell with my legs folded and my hands folded and being quiet was more difficult. I often, during that time when the weather was good, would go take long walks and through nature could sort of commune with the Creator. And that put me in sort of a meditative, quiet sort of space. But just sitting alone quietly didn't really work very well for me. It worked much better for me to be sitting at a loom with my hands moving. Meditation, basically, meditatio is from a word that comes from the same word for ruminating.
Oh, interesting.
Or sort of chewing the cud, going over and over and over again, sort of the same verse from scripture or from sacred texts or a particular thought process. And weaving is very much like that. Filling the shuttle and then emptying the shuttle by throwing it back and forth from salvage to salvage is going over and over and over again, getting to new territory each time, which is true of the meditative process also. But it's this repetitive process. It's part of both. For probably 8.5 years or so, I was encouraged by the superior who saw the effects of my sitting at the loom on my prayer life and my development spiritually. He absolutely encouraged it. But after about 8.5 years, there were some questions by some young monks about why does Brother Jeremy, who was how I was referred to, get to spend his meditation time sitting in the weaving studio working? He shouldn't be working, he should be praying. Well, I was praying, and that worked just fine. But to keep the peace, I was told I needed to spend more time just in my cell, being quiet and meditating by myself. The meditation we practiced at the monastery was called Lectio Divina. It's something that a lot of people on spiritual paths practice, but it's what the Benedictines called it. It's what St. Benedict calls it in the Rule of St. Benedict. And it basically is divine reading. So we would read scripture or sacred texts until something sort of moved us in our hearts or in our spirits, and then we would repeat that phrase over and over and over again over time. And oftentimes it would lead to a state of contemplation where you were sort of really in a different place and out of touch with this plane of reality. That happened for me at the loom. It absolutely happened for me at the loom. And at the loom, in many respects, it happened more with tapestry than it did with regular weaving. Because with tapestry, I was dealing with image, and it engaged me in the creative process in a way that sitting and figuring out drafts, which I enjoyed, because I did do complex weaving for a while, but in the end, a piece of cloth didn't have the same impact or the same meaning for me that an image in tapestry would have. It just seemed stronger, and it suited my needs better and my personality better.
When this question and controversy came up over your weaving during meditation, what happened then?
Well, I decided I would get a little frame loom and put it in my cell. I found a pipe clamp from the woodworking shop at the monastery, two of them, and leaned it up against the wall in my cell with a little picture frame attached to it. And I had some yarn. It didn't take much to bring some yarn to my cell. And the superior knew I was doing that, but I just wove in my cell. And that way people didn't know that I was... Other people didn't ask questions about how I was spending my meditation time because I was where I belonged, in the eyes of others.
I also find weaving to be very... It takes me out of myself. It makes me more peaceful. Your tapestries, they're really amazing in that when you first look at them, there's an overall sense of color because the color gradations in them are quite subtle. And then the longer you look, the deeper and deeper you fall into them as you notice extra little details. How did you get to a place where this is... what you're creating?
I don't know. It's been a long process. It's been a process that's taking place over 30 years at this point in time. And a lot of what I weave is really my response to my meditation. Back in the days when I was at the monastery, there was some emphasis at that point in time, I don't know if it's still true or not, on sort of an East-West dialogue of spirituality. Thomas Merton, who had been a Cistercian monk, and I had lived as a Cistercian monk for a short while before becoming a Benedictine. Both orders within the church follow the same rule, Benedict. The Cistercians were a reform of the Benedictines. I read pretty much everything that Thomas Merton wrote about spirituality and about East-West dialogue. My background from college was in anthropology and sociology, and so it was cultural exchange that was going on at that point in time in terms of spirituality fascinated me. And I found that reading some of the texts from particularly Zen sources made sense to me. I could relate to them. They moved me spiritually, intellectually, and emotionally, and were able to sort of engage me in a meditative practice that the Christian scriptures did sometimes, but didn't do as much. And so I was encouraged to use those scriptures. I mean, they were sacred texts. It really didn't matter. You know, whatever it was that moved you to this place that was out of yourself and in a communion with the Creator was fine. And so even now, I have particular Zen koans that I've become quite fond of. And oftentimes with the Zen koans, which are really conundrums, oftentimes there's very short little stories that are a bit of a dialogue between a master and a student or somebody he's mentoring. And they're asked to go away and think about this little story and try to figure it out. What was a master trying to get at in telling me this? And it becomes a source for meditation and for searching and a very important part of people's spiritual journey. There are several Zen koans that I've come across over time that have been important to me. They're really, in some ways, at the root of my design process, my creative process at this point in time, because the ideas, the concepts that are being expressed in these koans and in the documentaries or commentaries that are written about the koans, I'm trying to express in my work.
Do we get to know what some of the koans are?
Yeah. Yesterday in the other workshop that I taught on creative process, I actually read one of them. It is a koan called A Woman Caught in Absorption. And it's about a woman who is meditating and goes into a contemplative state and for some reason doesn't come back to this plane of reality, the plane that we know in everyday life. And several Buddhas come along and try to bring her back to the normal plane of reality and can't. And a Buddha comes along whose name is Ensnared Light and snaps his finger and she comes back. That's the koan. In the commentaries, there's a lot of talk about waves of relative truth in our lives, waves of absolute truth in our lives, and how those two types of truth come together in light. And for some reason, that's always intrigued me. When I first read that and read the commentary about the waves of relative truth, and I'm sitting at the loom every day as I do, or standing at the loom as I do, because I do both, and I have the weft thread moving in a sine wave motion through the warps as I'm weaving tapestries. All day long, I'm making these waves. There was a sort of a connection between what I'm actually doing with my hands at the loom and this particular koan. And so I wanted to explore it more. There are pages and pages of commentaries that I've spent a lot of time thinking about meditating on. And while at the loom, especially when I'm alone in the studio, I often have students, so I don't always have that luxury, but when I'm alone, that koan comes to mind in different phrases or paragraphs or thoughts that are put forth in the commentaries on that koan.
This idea of this koan, how do you translate something so abstract into a visual?
It's part of the creative process, and it's a part of it that is very difficult to describe. What I do is I read it, I think about it, I try to visualize it in my mind's eye in terms of the concept. It's relatively simple with that particular koan because you're talking about waves. And I'm weaving waves all the time. And we're at a conference called, you know, weaving waves of color. I mean, it's just sort of part of the process. And so in some ways it was maybe synchronicity or something that sort of brought all those things together and it just kind of made sense to me. And so doing a tapestry design or a drawing that would be the basis for an actual tapestry, a cartoon, that was based on all these waves made sense. And given my mind and the way that my mind works, after deciding I wanted to do that, and it actually happened after weaving a technique course like the one you will take in a few days, or tomorrow, starting tomorrow, and showing students how to weave waves, or how to weave curves. And I can just draw a sine wave very easily, and it's smooth and it's straight, and people are, you do that just like, yeah, it's easy. You know, it's just sort of in my psyche, because I weave these waves all the time. I see them all the time. I was doing this with a student one day, and I thought, I should really make that the basis for a design exercise that I'll do for myself. And I spent a year and a half doing that. I got out my physics books, I got out my calculus book, and some other science sort of books dealing with astronomy and other things. And the other component of that was when people would look at my work, they would often say, as you did, that it was about color. Color is what drew them to it initially. And color is reflected light waves. Reflected light, and what is light? Waves. I wanted to get to the essence of what it was in the tapestries that drew people to them. And if it was the color, in fact, then it had to do with these waves in the physical plane. We can't see them, but they're there. And then when you start studying the universe and physics, you know, there are electromagnetic waves and sound waves and all these other sorts of things that where we've created this paradigm of a wave structure to express it. And in lots of ways, that wave structure expressed for me the commentaries from this particular koan. It took about a year and a half.
So when people look at your work, what do you hope that they take away from it?
Oftentimes, people experience silence, and they experience quiet and solitude. It takes them to a place that's outside of themselves, in a place where it's calm and peaceful. They experience that in the work. I feel it's a good contribution to the world today.
Yes.
Yes.
With all our busyness mm-hmm. in our lives. Mm-hmm. I understand you do quite a bit of teaching, both at conferences like this one and from your studio.
I do. Convergence was in Denver 5 or 6 years ago, and an ex-student of mine, somebody I had taught a couple of different times actually, was the education chairperson for that conference and called me up and said, James, you have to come and teach at Convergence. It's in your backyard. It's in Denver. I had taught for years at the monastery, actually. Very shortly after I started weaving, the person who was in charge was sent away to study theology. And because I liked the process so much and was so excited about it, they put me in charge of the weaving shop. And so when new brothers would come in, I was the one who was teaching them. After not too long at the monastery, guests who were interested would help us with work periods. So I would often have both men and women in the weaving shop helping with various odd projects about the weaving shop. One of those brothers, as I mentioned earlier, called chooch work, winding skeins into balls and busy work. Guests who worked in the weaving shop would ask, well, can I learn to weave? They would make retreats, and during their retreats, they would request if they could work in the weaving shop and learn to weave. So I started teaching some of the guests to weave. I enjoy teaching. I enjoy that interaction. After I left the monastery, I was living in Velarde, which is between Santa Fe and Taos in New Mexico. The director or owner of the gallery where I showed in Taos was also on the board of directors of the Taos Art Institute. She showed my work and she knew my background and knew that I knew pretty much all aspects of weaving. I had done lots of plain weave and satin weave in summer and winter and crackle and worked with linens, and I had done all that at the monastery, but I also did tapestry. So she thought James would be a good person to be a teacher at the Art Institute because they were looking for a teacher to teach basic weaving and also somebody to teach basic tapestry. So she asked me to come and teach those things at the Art Institute. And I did that for 13 years, 2 courses in the summertime, and they were 2 5-day workshops, basically. At that point in time, I also showed in a gallery in Santa Fe. They were selling so much work that I really couldn't teach any more than that. Once in a while, somebody would come to the studio, and I had extra looms in the studio. And I always had this apprenticeship relationship with people in the studio. There was one time when I actually advertised one ads in the newspaper for an apprentice. I would have somebody come in, and I would teach them and work with them. And for every hour they were in the studio working on a loom and with me working with them, they would give me an hour back and do chooch work. So for 13 years, I taught at the Art Institute. I didn't teach more than that. But after the convergence in Denver, it all kind of snowballed because all of a sudden I was asked to teach in all these other places. And I thought, well, that's probably a good thing. I mean, I'm not an old man. I'm not a young man anymore either. And to work at the loom like I was, 10 or 12 hours every day, is not possible. At this point in life, everything on my body works fine, but it hasn't always. There were times when I was weaving so much that I started having pains in my hands and in my arms. This loom where I stand and work with locking treadles, I was having some pain in my hips. And I just decided I need to balance my life a little bit better and not be at the loom all the time. At that point, I also had a paid assistant who did all the finishing work so that I could just be weaving. And I had several apprentices who did all the dyeing and wound everything into balls and actually applied all of my single yarns together so that I could just weave. Not so long ago, I sort of finished building the dream studio that I always had in my mind. I worked really hard so that financially I would be able to do that. With that done, that kind of pressure is gone. And also the fact that I'm getting older and I just can't weave like that anymore is just the truth. That's the way it is. I still weave. I'm in the studio 50 or 60 hours a week when I'm not away teaching, but I'm not always at the loom. I do some of the dyeing myself. I have help with that. I ply all of my yarn on the spinning wheel myself as I'm weaving. I do all the finishing work myself, although I do have somebody who comes in one day a week and helps with finishing, but I do parts of it. It's better for my body at this point in time to balance out the various activities and not to just do one activity for 10 or 12 hours a day. I want to weave for at least 30 more years. I want my body to be able to cooperate with that too. So I found a different balance so that will be a possibility. The way I was weaving before, it would not have been a possibility. So the fact that I went to that convergence and the teaching sort of opportunity snowballed, I've just gone with it. The fact is that it's booking now into 2011 already. I have things booked for every month next year except January. And it's really too much. It's more than I want to be out of the studio. So I pretty much decided while I've been here that for 2011 I would get back to what I was doing before and probably go out of the studio once every other month for a week.
That's very smart of you to find a balance that's sustainable.
It's too much on the road, and it makes other parts of life a little bit more difficult. Friends and old partners and potential new partners sort of... You have to compromise to some extent. And I think it's better off for me, too, in lots of ways. And my studio is always open to students. I really much prefer teaching in my studio because it's a more one-on-one experience with the student who's coming. And people have come from all over the world to the studio. They see my interaction with the apprentices in the studio. It's never really just two of us there. And I can do my own work, and students learn from that. Going to the conferences and going to various schools, arts and crafts schools where I've taught, are a good thing because I meet people that way and more people want to come to the studio, so it's a good thing.
You mentioned you'd finally built your dream studio. Could you describe that a little bit?
8 years ago, I had been living on 10 acres off the grid on a mesa up southeast of Santa Fe. My mailbox was 6 miles away from my front door. It was quite remote. I had an apprentice at that time who would come to the studio several days a week, and we had a very rainy summer, and I had to go pick her up at the mailbox every day and come back into the studio at the beginning of the day, and then take her back out in the evening and come back to the studio. Each of those trips took 45 minutes.
Wow.
Because the road, it was mud. In New Mexico, we call it caliche. It's sort of this clay that sticks to your tires and to everything else, and you can't drive straight, and even with four-wheel drive, and it's a bit of a nightmare. And they're cliffs.
Whoa.
More than once, I did 360s in my car, or ended up in the ditch or whatever. Never got stuck, though. I just got tired of wasting so much time on the road. And so I looked for a place that was closer to Santa Fe. Santa Fe is an expensive place to live. For the kind of space I needed, I found this small subdivision about 20 minutes from the center of town. And so I looked there and I found a house that had a great living room and dining room that I thought would be a perfect studio with great windows and light and space. And I moved into it and decided to put the studio in the garage because I had never really had a house before. You know, I left the monastery really with two tapestries they gave me, and they let me a loom and I had to make my own way financially. So I thought I'd be a little extravagant and enjoy the house and that kind of space and use the garage, which was a nice space for the studio. So I insulated it and put heat out there and put another window out there, and it worked well, but it really was tight, especially with the apprentices coming and students coming from time to time. So I would sit at the loom and I would visualize what I wanted as a studio. I actually, at that point, had to go from the studio out a door, the back door, through my backyard, all the way around the other side of the studio and around to the front of the studio and into a gate to do the dyeing. And I had to carry hot pots of mixed dyes out there where the dye pots where the wool was. That was getting old, dangerous, and it would be easy to pull one's back out having to walk that far with those things, or to trip or to do something, because I had to go down several steps. And I just decided I needed to make it simpler for myself. Then I wasn't getting any younger and just wanted to make it easy and possible for me to keep doing what I was doing. I was working really hard, a lot of hours, and luckily selling a lot of tapestries, and sold enough tapestry and sort of recovered from buying the house financially, and sold enough tapestry in about a three-year period that I could build the studio. It was phenomenal. It totally floored me. And so I built a studio onto the studio I had been using, and now the studio is 1,600 square feet. There's a large studio area with looms. I have 8 looms in the studio. Most of them are Maycombers. 6 are Maycombers and 2 are Cranbrooks.
That's right, because you don't weave on tapestry looms.
No, I weave on floor looms, much in the Aubusson style. My largest loom is 100 inches wide. I'm weaving a commission on it right now for a Ritz-Carlton hotel. And it's a big piece and it's supposed to be done by the middle of June, so I have to go home and weave. But try not to think about that. Anyway, there's a separate dye area in the studio that's very close to a door that goes out to the outdoor dye pots, because I have the big pots outside, but I mix the dyes inside because of the powder and all of that. You don't want any air movement at all. You just don't want to make a mess, and you don't want to breathe it in.
Right.
You don't want other people to breathe it in. So I do all that in a very closed, smaller space. But the studio works very well, and I'm quite pleased with it.
When I think of tapestry looms, I usually think of the upright looms. Why did you choose to weave on a more traditional floor loom?
It's what I learned on. It's absolutely what I learned on. Actually, when I made final vows as a Benedictine monk, my mother wanted to give me a gift, and I said, well, I'd like this vertical tapestry loom. So she bought me, or bought the monastery, because I couldn't own anything, a 5-foot vertical tapestry loom. It was a beautiful loom. And I sat and I probably wove 3 or 4 tapestries on it, but my back and shoulders did not like that position. It was painful to sit there and work that way.
I would have thought that kind of leaning over would have been harder.
That just suits my body better.
Interesting.
But the other was really painful, especially in the upper back and across the shoulders. I might have been doing something wrong in the way I was sitting, but it just didn't work. There are a lot of tapestry traditions. In the Swedish tradition, they worked on floor looms and later developed more vertical looms. Native Americans work on vertical looms. A lot of the Mexican Zapotec-type weavers weave on horizontal looms. It goes either way, and within the French tradition, there are traditions there that do both. There's the Aubusson tradition, which is horizontal warp, and the Gobelin tradition, which is vertical warp.
I want to get back to your teaching for a moment. When you're teaching a new tapestry student, what is the most important thing you're trying to get across to them?
The way that I approach teaching and working with students and the way I approach my own work, that we have this sort of toolbox. I think that there are lots of different ways to approach it technically. I've explored and sort of come up with some ways that are quite unique that I enjoy passing on to students. Because I think they give a level of finesse you don't get with some of the techniques you find in some of the books. I certainly found my own creative voice through tapestry. And tapestry has given me so much in my own life. I mean, it's become my life. So much of my identity is not caught up with my job, but caught up with creative process through tapestry. If I can help other people find that, if they're meant to find it, that's just wonderful. I feel really fortunate to have found it in a very strange way at the monastery when I was 25 years old. The truth is I work with most people who are over 50. Most of the people who come to me, maybe 48 out of 50, are women. There are a few men. They're mostly people who are retired, who have time on their hands, who want to do something creative, who have always sort of wanted to work with fiber and not had the time.
Do you have any plans to write a book?
Yeah. There's actually a book being written right now as we speak. A former student of mine who I've mentored over several years, Carol Green, who was a professor of grammar, English in California for many years, is retired now, asked if she could write a biography. She has finished 50 chapters based on interviews with me. I have sort of rewritten the first 23 at this point in time, something we're working together in collaboration on. And I will go out to California again in July and spend a week and probably at least 2 more weeks this year before we finalize things. But that book will be finished and probably be published next year. Students for years have asked me for a technique book. Many of the techniques that I teach are found in books, but I've tweak them a little bit, if you would. Added a level of finesse that's not described in many of the books. And with some of the things that I show students, you won't find it anywhere unless you've taken a workshop with me. It's important for that to be written down, but and it is going to be. I've actually been working with somebody over time with an online course. I really don't want to do that anymore. It takes too much time, too much sitting at the computer typing. You know, basically you're writing the book while you're trying to verbally describe with words on the computer how to do things, because they're not there and I can't show them how to do things.
Have you ever considered video?
A video has been done, actually, a very short video about my work. It was done maybe 15 years ago. It's not an instructional video, but it does show me weaving and shows me dyeing and shows sort of the whole process. It was done more for the galleries and for collectors. I think doing a book is the way that I'm going to go in terms of the technique book. It's next on the list. Learning tapestry technique is sort of a process from my point of view and the way that I teach and the way that I approach it. You know, we do have this toolbox and all these possibilities, and I'm always learning and exploring new and maybe better ways of doing things, but there's certainly different ways of doing things, different approaches to design problems that come up while you're at the loom. The toolboxes have very full at this point in time, so I think I'm ready to do it. Until this point, I was still exploring too much and I wasn't ready to write it down yet. And then we'll do a coffee table book. Carol has these three books she wants to do. You know, the biography, and then the technique book, and then the coffee table book. And I've woven so many tapestries that will be easy. But
sounds like you have a busy and full life. What's next for you?
Next for me is to go home and finish the commission. That's not my loom. And I have a show scheduled at this point for the Maxwell Museum in Albuquerque. It's going to be a show of my work and the work of two people I've been mentoring for several years now. And one of the women is actually from Germany and had grown up in Erfurt, which is the city that's very close to Weimar, which is where the Bauhaus began. And she didn't have much familiarity with the Bauhaus until she came and took a workshop with me. And I started talking about the Bauhaus in Weimar, and her ears perked, you know. So I've worked with her now for several years and another student. And they're both people who are in their 30s. They're young, and it's really fun and exciting to be working with them. And generally, every 2 to 3 weeks, they come to my studio for a Sunday afternoon. We've been going through chapter by chapter Paul Klee's notebooks and his approach to design. And he was actually the main teacher in the weaving workshop at the Bauhaus for much of the duration of the Bauhaus. And so he was teaching the Bauhaus weavers about design, and we're looking at all those principles and looking at them pretty much in depth. And as a result of all of that, and the fact that this year is the 90th anniversary of the Bauhaus, I've been asked to go and teach a workshop at the Bauhaus University and have a show at church in Erfurt, which was actually built in the, I think, 11th century or 12th century. It was bombed during the last war there, and they're all clear glass windows and walls that go up under the windows about 6 feet or so. And we've got the whole space to fill with the work from the three of us. The show that will be at the Maxwell Museum is really it's going to be up for 6 months, but it's going to be, there's going to be a reception and an opening in conjunction with Convergence, which is the biennial weaving conference that happens, and it will be in Albuquerque. It's really exciting to do that, and I think it's exciting to show somebody who's a mentor and two people who he's mentored over time, and to show their work together. I think it'll be fun for people to see that.
Yeah, you can see the influences. It'll be very interesting. Mm-hmm. Cool.
So that's kind of what's lined up, at least for the next year and a half or so.
Thank you so much for taking time. And
you're welcome. It's been a pleasure. And I look forward to working with you the next 3 days.
Yeah, you're going to help me figure out those 40 wefts and what to do with them.
Yes.
That's all for this episode, and now it's time to get warped, because everyone knows you have to be warped to weave. Our sponsor this episode is Lunatic Fringe Yarns. They sell a variety of yarns and weaving kits, including their famous Tubular Spectrum and Gray Matter Color Gamp kits. You can find them online at lunaticfringeyarns.com. And whenever you're contacting one of our wonderful sponsors, please be sure to tell them that you heard their spot on WeaveZine. WeaveZine is also brought to you through the donations of listeners just like you. If you're interested in helping support the site and keeping the servers running, please go up to the WeaveZine.com site and see the Server Food button. Thank you, as always, for your support.